Happy Wednesday, 6:05. Good to have you. Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds. It's a Wednesday.
It's a hump day.
And we have a lot to do. And I'll tell you, this situation with these ACA subsidies, who could have seen this coming? Right? Like, so the Senate goes ahead and makes this deal. Six Democrats jump over. They break the stalwart, and they go out and they reopen the government, right?
Yep.
Well, part of the handshake agreement there was that there was going to be real discussions and a vote on these ACA subsidies. Well, they did have a vote in the Senate.
Yeah.
They didn't have the 60 votes needed.
No.
Didn't have the 60 votes needed for the Republican plan, so those fall to the wayside. And now you've got Mike Johnson saying that they're not going to take this up in the House before the break.
Yeah, he's saying we're just not even going to do it, and we're going to leave for the Christmas break. They're off on Friday. And it seems like moderates in the House are not that happy about it. Mike Lawler told reporters that, you know, Johnson refusing to give this extension a vote is idiotic. It's political malpractice. Now, the speaker is stuck between the conservatives who will never vote for an ACA extension and the moderates there in his House. And, you know, I don't envy him. He has some tough choices to make all the time. But not taking up the vote at all could be a political mistake.
I almost would think it probably makes more sense if you're a Republican, only because you're going to shield Republicans that don't want to vote for this.
Right.
Right? Because if you go, I don't want to vote for these subsidies and I want to make sure that people's health care is more expensive, that's a tough sell. So if Mike Johnson takes the heat and just goes, I'm not bringing it to the floor, the Mike Lawlers of the world can come forward and say, this is crazy. We need to vote on this. Healthcare is too expensive.
Exactly.
And then all the other Republicans don't have to deal with it. They don't have to have a blemish on their record. So it might just be cover.
It could be. But then you got this precedent of the discharge petition when it comes to the Epstein files. And Hakeem Jeffries wants a discharge petition. Could these moderate Republicans sign on to that and force it?
I don't know. That would be wild.
That would be.
We're 2 days away.
Two days away
from the Epstein release.
Friday.
Yeah, I can't wait for all of the information to come out. It's going to be all of the things we need.
All of everything. Mm-hmm. Every single piece of information.
But you know, with the ACA, I mean, you know, understand that the subsidies would keep the prices down, but those prices are going to go up now, and it's affecting both sides of the aisle. It's not just affecting Democrats. It's Republicans that are on ACA, too.
Sure.
Their premiums are going to go up as well. So, you know, they're going to get a lot of flack when they go back home from the people in their districts on ACA right now.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Maybe people are focused on the holidays and it won't matter in the immediate, but at some point they're going to have to face that
reckoning.
It's going to
matter when they see that bill.
At some point, it's going to matter to people.
Yes.
And they're going to have to do something. They're going to have to do something, whether it's these HSA accounts that the Republicans are planning or re-upping these subsidies for the Fetterman plan for a year while they work this out, whatever. They're going to have to do something because you just can't have millions and millions of people's premiums go up that they can't afford in the first place.
Exactly.
What is going on with this Nick Reiner story? This is wild to me. Absolutely wild. So he goes to this Conan O'Brien party and is acting
weird,
shady and weird and shifty, and he's asking Bill Hader what his first and last name is and if he's a celebrity.
Yeah.
And he's having these conversations with a bunch of people at the party. Then he's asked to leave. Like people is reporting that Nick Reiner got into a big fight at Conan O'Brien's party. This is the headline. He was freaking everyone out.
And his father said, you're acting inappropriate, and they got into it. He was asked to leave.
A precursor? I mean, could this have been the springboard to what ended up happening? I don't know, but this is very strange.
Charges were officially filed yesterday for Nick Reiner. Two counts of first-degree murder, but a special circumstance under these deaths could mean that he could face the death penalty. It's a family tragedy because the story is that a massage therapist came to the gate, wasn't answering. They called the daughter. The daughter got in, walked in, and found her dad and immediately left and didn't even know her mom was also in there.
Oof. Oh, boy, oh, boy. Terrible.
Detroit Police Chief Todd Bettison, well, he's going to continue leading the department under Mayor-elect Mary Sheffield. The mayor announcing yesterday that Bettison, who became interim chief in October of 2024 and permanent chief in February, has nearly 3 decades of experience with the Detroit Police Department, including a stint as first assistant chief in serves as deputy mayor under Mike Duggan. She brings with her a respect for peers, the loyalty the loyalty of the rank and file and the trust of the people. That's according to the mayor-elect. She praised Bettison's leadership and his strong ties to Detroit neighborhood. And during Bettison's tenure, violent crime in the city has dropped to historic lows, a trend he hopes to continue under Sheffield's administration. He says his goal is to keep pushing crime down while enhancing public safety for all neighborhoods. So she had said during the campaign that she was going to keep him around, and she made good on that promise, reappointing him yesterday.
Interesting. Usually a mayor wants to
bring in their own
person.
Yeah. So
What is going on with the Trump administration in Venezuela? Because it sure seems like we are marching towards some sort of, I don't know, military action, regime change, if you will. The president ordered a total and complete blockade of sanctioned Venezuelan oil tankers. So I think that since they're sanctioned vessels, perhaps they can sidestep a little of these prohibitions in international law. Like, it's different because they're sanctioned. I don't know. But there's a lot of firepower of the U.S. in that area now, too.
Yes.
11 warships are in the Caribbean. That's the most in decades, according to ABC. But it doesn't seem like this can be a full blockade. A blockade is like you can't get
you
through.
Yeah.
Right? You can't.
But
you
Chevron
can.
Right. Therefore, it's not.
Well, but they have, what, 30 different oil tankers in that region? Mm-hmm. The United States has 11 warships. I mean, it doesn't seem like it would work necessarily, but yes, the Chevron piece to this is
they're like
is
Chevron.
There as well.
You can go ahead and continue to do your business.
Right.
A Chevron spokesperson said that the operations in Venezuela are continuing without disruption. They're good.
Interesting. Did you guys see any of this interview with Susie Wiles, the chief of staff to Donald Trump?
I read some of it. I didn't read all of it
with Vanity Fair.
Yeah, I read a lot of things.
You know, there was obviously some pushback from even moderate Republicans that are saying this is troubling, things like that. But Donald Trump has come out in support even after this interview was released. This was an 11-month process over many interviews. And there was a number of things covered in this. And one of them was early in the administration, I think it was March, Susie Wiles says that Donald Trump is not on a retribution tour, that there are things that are going to happen that people will view as retribution, but it's not. And that her message to him had always been, you don't want what happened to you to happen to other people.
Mm-hmm.
So don't take the political aspect of trying to this political prosecution over, you know, what happened to you. You didn't like it. They won't like it. It's not a good look.
Right.
She talked about how Donald Trump's in great health. She talked about these Venezuelan boats that are being targeted in these military strikes. She says they're blowing up the boats until Maduro cries uncle. They obviously want a regime change. They're not saying that out loud, but that's what they want.
Mm-hmm.
She talked about the Jeffrey Epstein files, saying Pam Bondi completely whiffed on the handling of that when she came out and said that she's got the client list on her desk ready for review.
Says she never did.
And then she says, I've seen the Epstein files. There's nothing in it. There is no client list. There's nothing resembling that. And she said that there's no evidence that Bill Clinton visited Epstein's island as many as 28 times as Donald Trump has said. She said
Trump has.
The president was wrong about that.
But didn't she say Trump was on the plane?
She said that Donald Trump is in the files, but wasn't doing anything crazy.
Yeah.
Not doing anything awful was the actual quote. And she said that Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein were, quote, young single playboys together. She's come out and said that this was a hit piece that Vanity Fair picked and choosed and created a different narrative than what she had given.
Well, MAGA's just mad because she sat down with Vanity Fair in the first place, you know, and talked to them for, you know, over so many interviews for 11 months. But, I mean, you know, she knew she was on the record, whatever she said. And it, you know, it's being taped as well. So you can't go back and say, well, I didn't say that or, you know, because she has said some of the things, well, I didn't say that. And the reporter has pushed back and said, yeah, you did, and played the tape, and it's her voice. So, I mean, what do you do?
Mm. I have thoughts, but we're at the end. We'll talk about it.
Congress got a briefing from Pete Hegseth about these Venezuelan boat strikes. We'll talk to Evan Brown next here on JR Morning. So Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says this video of that second strike and the initial strike on that boat on September 2nd that was allegedly running drugs to the United States will not be released, won't be released to the public, won't be released to members of Congress. And they were briefed on this. And while some have seen it, including Chuck Schumer, he says that he doesn't believe that this exonerates Pete Hegseth in any way, doesn't believe it exonerates Admiral Frank Bradley in any way, and that it is a disturbing video and people should see it. But then there are Republicans that are saying something similar. It should be available to members of Congress. Lindsey Graham, people like Tom Tillis, John Cornyn, saying that all of this information should be made available to at least Congress with the necessary redactions in place. Will we get that? Doesn't seem like it. Eben Brown's the Fox correspondent and WJR contributor, joins us this morning. Eben, it's good to have you.
Good morning.
So what's the rationale here from Pete Hegseth's perspective to not release this to even members of Congress?
Well, that it's classified and that puts in a problem for releasing it even to some members of Congress if they don't have certain levels of clearance. So that's a big problem there. Not to speak for the secretary himself, but to say that his descriptions and testimony about it should really suffice, that this is what happened. This is what the operation was. They've been rather forthcoming even to the public about what went down during it, and that there really isn't much more to say, I don't think, other than that there are some classified matters that can't be shared with everyone. But that the U.S. is involved in an anti-drug operation against what is essentially a hostile nation. This is more than just simple gangs or cartels, but that they're operating under state orders and state protection and all that comes with that from Venezuela. There may be more to hear tonight when President Trump is supposed to address the nation in a primetime address. And there's some big belief that this will concern more things to do with Venezuela. Last night, the president did announce that he would be instituting a naval blockade of Venezuelan oil tankers. He is declaring the government of Venezuela to be a foreign terrorist organization. This is pretty serious stuff, and it does feel like the U.S. is going into a war footing, which is peculiar considering the president did campaign on a no more wars, no more foreign wars type of pitch to the American public. However, the president has been very open in asserting the Monroe Doctrine, something that was devised by President Monroe way, way back when, saying that this is our neck of the woods, this our hemisphere, and other foreign actors who would look to use the Western Hemisphere to impugn U.S. activity and strength are going to be hit back pretty hard. And so the president seems to be doing that. Venezuela has been in cahoots with America's enemies, namely China, namely Cuba, namely Russia. And part of that has to do with drug running that is sanctioned and even protected in many ways by the Maduro regime.
Eben, politically, though, how does withholding the video fuel skepticism, especially when the president initially said he was open to releasing it? I mean, a lot of people feel like there's less about national security, maybe more about controlling the narrative.
Well, I think the Congress, especially Democrats in Congress, it probably will never be satiated. That's one thing. It's more interesting that there are Republicans in the Congress who are saying that it should be released. However, I don't think they've been all that forceful with the president on this. And I think that there are some political concerns, of course. The president does want to control the narrative. I think he makes that pretty obvious at this point. I think the president has felt burned in the past by even people in his own party that have not supported him. He's learned to play things, I think, a bit more closer to the vest. At some point, though, the Congress is going to have to address whether or not the War Powers Act is being used appropriately here, and do they need to give the president any more permission to continue to do what he's doing. That's a whole legal argument to make, and at some point maybe that has to be addressed more succinctly.
I just feel like from the public's perspective, we feel like, okay, you've been tweeting out these videos of all these strikes, and then when there's a question about it, now it's like, well, we can't release that. That's classified. It just feels odd?
Well, I mean, it may feel odd, and there may be plenty of people who will demand to see it in the public, and there will be plenty of people who support the president who say, look, I know what one of these strikes looks like. I don't need to see every last one of them. They give the president their trust. I think it's going to be politicized more than anything. Mm-hmm. And I think some of these discussions about whether or not it should be released might be interesting on Capitol Hill in certain journalistic circles. I think the person getting into his pickup truck every day and going to work probably isn't sweating it out too much on this.
Well, then what's the scuttlebutt as Donald Trump prepares to address the nation tonight? You mentioned that you believe that it might have something to do with Venezuela. What are we expecting to hear?
Well, the president, like I said, the president is putting in a naval blockade of Venezuelan oil. Venezuela uses its oil sales illicitly, meaning to get around sanctions, to sell oil to China and whatnot. I think the president may be addressing this matter tonight. Maybe he's going to announce that there's some kind of further hostile action to take. Otherwise, aside from that, I mean, I don't know what else it could be, but it could be other things. The president's been dealing with a number of issues, Ukraine and Russia, Israel and Gaza, so on and so forth. But the theme this week seems to be more Venezuela focused, at least out of the White House.
Evan Brown, appreciate your insights as always. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Yeah,
we will carry that tonight as well, just so you know, the president's address at 9 o'clock here on WJR.
Yeah. And things are ramping up with Venezuela. I mean, there's no doubt about that. With this naval blockade, these strikes, I mean, things are happening here. So is this a precursor to just prepare the American people that there might be military action against Venezuela at this point?
Is this a Christmas message and you know, nothing at all? Or is this like a preparation to say, hey, we're going to take action in Venezuela? Mm-hmm. It seems like the latter to me.
Or will he take action and tell us that they just took action during this address?
Yeah, that might feel a little too pre-planned. Maybe. I think anything is up for grabs at this point. Anything. But it'll be interesting to hear what he has to say, particularly with some of these decisions that have been made. I'm with a lot of these Republicans, though. Release the video.
Yeah.
Release it. Because what you do by keeping it under wraps is you fuel conspiracy theories.
Conspiracy, right.
So there's no need for that.
It was also fueled by releasing all the other videos on social media.
Yeah,
exactly.
No doubt. All right, take a break. More next with Jeremy. So 11 months of interviews with Susie Wiles, the chief of staff to President Donald Trump, culminated in a piece in Vanity Fair. It was a two-part article. And there were a number of things said in this piece. Said that Donald Trump was doing a fantastic job. But there was some critical aspects, too. Like she said, Donald Trump has an alcoholic personality, that he doesn't drink. He has never had a drink, but he has a very possessive personality. And it at times gives him this feeling that he can do anything, say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been pushback on that. But the president has come out and said, she's doing a great job. Obviously, somebody very close to him, not only throughout his presidency, but throughout his campaign. Somebody he credited with the win. Her ideas in the campaign, they used a lot. And she came out and then has said that Vanity Fair took liberties here, and this was more of a hit piece than an informational piece. A real kind of look into what the administration's doing.
I'm interested in the process here. She clearly talked to this reporter a lot during these 11, 12 months of the first year. And so what did she think was going to happen if you said some of these things, that he was just going to keep it under the vest and they were friends? I mean, I'm interested in what she thought was happening here. Was it all off the record on background? I don't know, because some of the things, she's been so good for the president in terms of his campaign and as the chief of staff, that it seems counter to that a little bit.
And these were interviews that were conducted, from what I understand, on Sundays after church. And these were the interviews that she had with Vanity Fair. MAGA saying, listen, why are you sitting down with Vanity Fair or any left-leaning publication? You shouldn't have did it in the first place. And the president said in the New York Post yesterday, he said, listen, I haven't read it, but she said something about me having an alcoholic personality. He says, I don't drink, you know, but if I did, I probably would have that type of personality. He really kind of went along with it, didn't really push back. He just kind of went along and said, hey, she's doing a great job.
But she also talked about Elon Musk.
Yeah.
In this piece.
Yeah.
And by the way, whatever may have happened with Elon and Donald Trump and their whole falling out might be somewhat repaired because he's getting involved. He's going to start funneling in lots of money, sure, again, millions, mm-hmm, and millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. But she said the challenge with Elon is keeping up with him. He's an avowed ketamine user, and he sleeps in a sleeping bag in the EOB, the executive office building, in the daytime. And he's an odd, odd duck, as I think geniuses are. You know, it's not helpful, but he is his own person.
Then I thought she said she didn't
say that.
Checks
out for everything people thought.
Then I thought she said she didn't say that, and the reporter has it on tape that she did.
Yeah, it's a very strange dynamic, this piece.
She talks about the retribution tour that, mm-hmm, the president is supposedly on, and that she gave him 90 days. And, quote, we have a loose agreement that the score settling will end before the first 90 days are over. When that did not happen by August, she told the reporter, Mr. Whipple, that I don't think he's on a retribution tour, but said that he was aiming at people who did bad things and coming after him. In some cases, it may look like retribution, she said, and there may be an element of that from time to time. Who would blame him? Not me. So, acknowledging that he's going after his political enemies. Mm-hmm. There were just some wild things.
She called J.D. Vance a conspiracy theorist?
For a decade.
Yeah. For a decade.
A long-running conspiracy theorist.
She was asked, Vanity Fair asked Susie Wiles about J.D. Vance's position on Donald Trump, because he was not a fan of Donald Trump initially.
Right.
No.
But she said that his conversion came when he was running for Senate, and I think his conversion was a bit more sort of political. And when asked about this, J.D. Vance said, I realized I actually liked him. I thought he was doing a lot of good things, and I thought he was fundamentally the right person to save the country.
That's the thing. It wasn't just Susie Wiles being interviewed.
Right.
J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio.
Oh, no.
Posed for that picture that looked like it was straight, yes, out of the show Dynasty.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So there was obviously an administrative, you know, push to be a part of this expose, this big, long-ranging piece.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting to me, so Donald Trump kind of gave the stamp of approval. He said he has not read the piece.
That is his MO when things are difficult. I haven't seen it.
I don't know about it.
I don't know it.
Yeah.
But he said that Susie Wiles is doing a great job. I think it speaks a little bit to where the administration is at on the media. You know, they're willing to be out in front. They are. Whether you like what they say or not,
mm-hmm,
they are everywhere. I mean, constantly.
Yeah,
I give them that.
And so that is a good thing, mm-hmm, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But what they like to do is be available, and then if something gets portrayed a certain way or written a certain way, they go, this is propaganda, mm-hmm, this is a hit piece,
yeah,
this is yada yada. I don't know that you can have it both ways. You either participate knowing that you don't like Vanity Fair,
right,
knowing that what they could do to you,
mm-hmm,
or you do the piece and you go, yeah, I said what I said.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that you can have your cake and eat it too in this situation,
well,
but that is something that they like to do.
It's just hard
that
too
is
when it's taped.
Also, an MO,
yeah,
to, you know, it's easily researched. You can figure out that is fact, and still there'll be tweets being like, I didn't say that. No, that's wrong. That's fake news. And in fact, like, every cabinet member simultaneously put out statements supporting Susie Wiles after the Vanity Fair article came out. I mean, it was coordinated. Doug Burgum, Scott Bessent, Kash Patel, all of them. Same kind of thing. And one of them reads, like, for instance, Doug Burgum, I have known and worked with Susie Wiles for years, and she's an extraordinary leader. She's disciplined, smart, insightful, strategic, and extraordinarily calm under pressure. And all of the tweets look the same.
I mean, and that may be true.
Mm-hmm.
It may be true. Susie Wiles may, I mean, here's the other part. is it sounds like Susie Wiles is able to push back on Donald Trump. Like, there was at one point where she got up from a cabinet meeting, and he's like, is this an emergency?
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, it's an emergency. It doesn't concern you. And walked out of the room. To the president of the United States. Like, you know, that takes some gumption.
It does.
You can't just walk out of a meeting like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think that she operates on a different plane. I think that she has the ability to work with Donald Trump in ways that others don't.
I agree. Because most chief of staffs, that's what they do. They are the ones who push back and, you know, say, Mr. President, you know, maybe not this way, maybe this way, you know, and push back. Now, it may not all, the president may not go with that, but they are the ones who do that. So, yeah, I see her being the one to push back. But you're pushing back against Donald Trump, who was going to do whatever he wants to do.
Well, she said if there's a tie that he wins, he's the decider.
Absolutely. No doubt. Absolutely.
She also made it clear, like, you know, the John Kelly time when he was, like, trying to push back on certain things he found to be sort of radical or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
She made it clear in this piece that her mission is to facilitate President Trump's desires, even if she sometimes thinks he's going too far.
Well, and I think that that's appropriate. I mean, again, whether you think Donald Trump's going too far is another question.
Yeah.
She's not the decision maker.
No, the bottom line, the buck stops with the press.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In every situation.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk to Mark Fendrick coming up at the University of Michigan, because it doesn't seem like we're going to get a decision on these ACA subsidies. Doesn't seem like we're going to get a Republican plan to help bring down the cost of health care. We'll talk to him about what that means coming up next. But first, at 6:44, time for this week's S&P Global Mobility Minute with Mike Wall.
As 2025 draws to a close, the auto industry continues to navigate an evolving U.S. trade environment, as well as other regional dynamics. Assumptions regarding tariffs remain largely intact as automakers' strategies in mitigating the impacts continue to evolve. Companies are spreading the cost and price impact pragmatically across markets and are adjusting content, trim, and mix accordingly. Additionally, automakers operating in the U.S. are benefiting from not facing emissions penalties and the need to purchase regulatory credits. The net effect, consumers are not expected to bear as much of the burden by way of major price increases, yet the cost implications of some of the more severe tariff impacts will still prove impactful to consumer demand and resulting production as we look to next year. Looking to North America, S&P Global Mobility's latest light vehicle production outlook was upgraded by 288,000 units for 2026 and now stands at 15.1 million units relative to a forecasted 15.2 million units for 2025. On a combination of an increased demand outlook, efforts to keep inventory on pace with demand, and the recovery of lost volume stemming from the situation surrounding Novelis and Nexperia. The U.S. light vehicle sales outlook for 2026 was increased by 140,000 units and stands at 15.9 million units relative to a forecasted 16.3 million units for 2025. I'm Mike Wall with this week's Automotive Minute from S&P Global Mobility.
Speaker Mike Johnson said there will not be an amendment vote on extending expiring Obamacare subsidies as part of, you know, what they're doing here right before Christmas. And so what does that mean for the regular folks? Let's bring in Mark Fendrick, professor of internal medicine at the School of Medicine and your health management professor also in the School of Public Health at University of Michigan. Your title, Mark, is so long.
Time to cut it short, Jamie.
Mark Fendrick, really University of Michigan.
Yeah, really happy to hear the weather going into the 40s here.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
All right, let's talk about this. You know, he says he's not going to bring this up for a vote, so it will mean that these premiums go up for people. But I'm wondering your thoughts on the Republicans put out a plan for, a different way of doing things. What did you think of that?
Yeah, I'm not so sure it's that much different. I think the Republicans and Democrats are playing a game of chicken here to see who's going to take the blame for the fact that hundreds of thousands of people in Michigan and millions across the country are going to see markedly higher premiums for their health insurance. And what worries me, Jamie, of course, is that there'll be a whole bunch of people who just say, I can't afford it anymore, and go back to the future and have our uninsured problem that we had prior to Obamacare. So the issues of buying health care costs straight state lines, which is a big issue in the House, and this idea that tying on to the president's idea of putting money into the patient's pockets and not in the insurance companies, which was considered in the Senate but did not make that, suggests that some of these new or old ideas are not popular enough to make this into law.
You know, you had a Republican leader who pointed out that roughly three quarters of the ACA enrollees live in states that Donald Trump won. I mean, is there a disconnect between the political framing of Obamacare and who actually relies on it?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Lloyd. I think the ACA has gone through its troubles, but it's more popular now than it's ever been since its passage in 2010. And while a lot of the things that you're talking about and people around kitchen tables are issues of food and rent and other types of affordability, but the fact that the typical insured American, it costs their employer over $25,000 or what some people like to say a new car every year, the Americans themselves pick up a quarter of that cost. And as those costs rise, the pressures become increasingly hard to pay for all the things that we need to buy.
Well, this is the problem with the Republicans now is doing away with the ACA is just a non-starter, it seems like, but they want to take these HSA accounts forward. You said that you don't think they're that different. Why?
Well, no, the ideas are, you know, we've been talking about repeal and replace for a very longer than we've known each other, Chris. And,
yeah.
And the idea of the idea of getting rid of Obamacare is, as you said, it's kind of lost its luster. And despite the idea of different approaches to what the Republicans could do, there's never anything that's kind of caught fire enough to see that the conservatives who don't like Obamacare at all, and now the growing group of moderates who are at risk in, who are in those situations where, you know, Lloyd had mentioned in districts where a lot of people are on the exchanges and getting subsidies for health insurance are really going to see this be problematic. I do think that, and we've talked about health savings accounts for the right person. I think it's only brand new that HSAs or health savings accounts are allowable on the exchanges through the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. And that only applies to a certain number of those types of plans that are available on the exchange and not all of them. So implementing this would be very, very complicated. And in my opinion wouldn't reach a significant number of people who need to get their health insurance to be affordable.
Mark, we're talking about these enhanced subsidies, not the whole thing, right?
Correct.
The Census Bureau says that insurance coverage showed that the share of Americans with any coverage hasn't changed since 2019, despite these enhanced subsidies. But enrollment in employer plans has declined. So it seems like those enhanced subsidies are very, you know, enticing to people, that they'd rather be on that than their employer plans.
Yeah, I mean, any subsidy is very valuable, which is why it's the issue of the Democrats know that people really like them. And certain Republicans are completely valid in making their point that they're very, very expensive. And we're not exactly sure what we're getting in terms of health care gains. And then there's this issue that was brought up last week, that there is a number of people who enroll on these subsidized exchange plans who shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's anywhere near as large as a problem as some people are clamoring about fraudulent enrollment. But like many policies that impact millions, it is imperfect, and there will be some things that go awry. But the bottom line is that, sadly, in my opinion, the four of us are going to sit around and to see what the ramifications are when we know that in just in a few days, when we know these subsidies aren't extended, that people will have to pay up to double and sometimes more their premiums that they're paying now, and that we will see, depending on you listen to, a large number of people who just decide not to pay their premiums at all.
So, Professor, you know, if people lose coverage or they delay care, I mean, are we actually saving money, or are we just shifting costs elsewhere in the system?
Yeah. You should become a professor of health management and policy. That would give you a shorter, a longer title for you and a shorter one for me. So these are the issues that we're talking about. And again, we've lived through these before. Uninsured doesn't mean get no care. And people who can't afford care means that someone has to pay for it somewhere. So I do believe, Lloyd, that those of us who remain insured will have to pick up part of the bill to see the impact of those people who don't get their preventive care services, don't have a primary care clinician, and delay care till things are too late, which is often worse for their health outcomes, which matters to me, and often more and more expensive, which pertains to public and private payers.
It's such a complicated issue. I appreciate talking about it, but we need our lawmakers to sit down and really figure this out. Yeah. Mark Fendrick, we appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a good rest of your day.
You
too.
Thank
you.
I'm sure they'll do just that.
Of course they will. I mean, right before they leave.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And forget about like what, you know, the Twitter is saying, whatever. Yeah. Just get in a room and figure this out.
Well, at this point, roll with the Fetterman plan.
Mm-hmm. I like the Fetterman plan.
Extend it for a year.
Yeah, yeah, 1 year.
Exactly. Extend the subsidies for a year.
Right.
Make sure that people's costs don't go up now.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that can be a political win for Donald Trump at this point. And then you try to figure
it out.
Sit
down and negotiate. And get it. You got a year.
I don't even think you need, at this point, I don't even know if you're in negotiation. Come up with a legitimate plan. Like, come up with something that will appease people that are on this without taking away their insurance. Look, the cat's out of the bag. I don't know how you roll this program back now. I'm not a huge fan of it, personally, but I don't know how you pull that rug out from under people at this point. So come up with something.
Sit in a room and talk about it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's go into the 7 o'clock hour here on JR Morning. We're going to talk about the Rob Reiner tweet when it comes to the president and the economy. Is it healthy or not? We'll ask the former senior economic advisor to the president at 7:35.
7 o'clock hour. Good to have you this Wednesday morning. By the way, we do have an opportunity for you. At the end of the show, when we play Name That Tune, Josh Groban coming to
town.
Huge. Little Caesars Arena.
That's big.
That's coming to coming in June. Tickets just went on sale yesterday. So they're a hot ticket. Jennifer Hudson will be there as well. So we'll give you an opportunity if you play along, Name That Tune later on.
I always think, I'm like, man, you know, the tickets go on sale and the concert is not until June or March or April. But, you know, people get into it. And they make good Christmas gifts, actually.
Well, sure they do.
You know, you have one sale before Christmas. That's a nice gift.
Absolutely.
Lloyd Jackson, a marketer at heart.
Yeah. What are you working for, 313 Presents now? Jeez, oh, Pete. Yeah. Donald Trump set to address the nation tonight at 9 o'clock. You'll hear it here on WJR. He put out yesterday, "My fellow Americans, I will be giving an address to the nation tomorrow night, live from the White House at 9 p.m. I look forward to seeing you then. It has been a great year for our country, and the best is yet to come." Then you add Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt saying that Donald Trump would be addressing the country about all of his historic accomplishments over the past year and maybe teasing some policy that will be coming in the new year as well.
See, her tweet makes it seem like, you know, Christmas message, end of the year, what's coming up. But then you have the timing of the military conducting these strikes on more drug smuggling boats, all these carriers and all the firepower of
naval blockade on Venezuela
heading in that direction. Part of me is wondering if there's going to be an announcement with that.
I don't know what to expect. I mean, if Caroline Leavitt is saying, you know, great year, you know, we did well and can't wait for next year, it does seem like that would be very different from what we're kind of reading into the tea leaves. So that'll be interesting. Meanwhile, Pete Hegseth on that front saying that he will not release the video of that second strike on that initial target of the drug boat that was running on September 2nd, took two strikes to eliminate the target. He says that they will not release, even to members of Congress, that video.
Well, the president had initially said he was open to release it, but I guess something changed, and, you know, the narrative has to be the way the narrative is with Pete Hegseth. It's, I don't know what keeping it, you know, classified does, but.
It's just the perception always, right? Like, they tweeted out all the videos, not all, but most of the videos of these strikes.
Of the strikes, yeah.
You know, touting that this was a major success. Then one of the papers does a story on that, oh, there were two strikes on the same boat. It creates this firestorm, and now they don't want to release the second one. It's like, why? Because of the allegations of a war crime or because it is classified? But it makes people think.
It does make people think. You had Republicans saying, well, this was the sources that they were talking to who have seen the video said that it exonerates Pete Hegseth. It would clear the air. It would do away with this conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so why not release it if that's the case? Makes me think that that's not the case, and that's why you don't want it released. Democrats are saying, doesn't matter. We want it released. We think everybody should see it. So that continues to go back and forth.
Detroit's Police Oversight Board, the Board of Police Commissioners, they're weighing a major shift banning minor traffic stops for things like tinted windows and expired tags. Now, the move follows at least 9 Detroit police shootings during traffic stops over the last 10 years, nearly all involving black men under 33. Now, proponents point to Washtenaw County, where similar restrictions led to a 70% drop in minor stops and 54% decrease in aggravated assaults involving officers. However, police unions warn these stops are vital tools for finding illegal guns. And with Detroit's board seeking to reduce racial profiling, all eyes are on Mayor-elect Mary Sheffield's administration to see if the Motor City will join 32 other jurisdictions nationwide in changing how police patrol the streets. I don't think
so. Are they making a connection between these stops for expired tags and police shootings on young black men?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And also officer involved shootings as well, you know, and where they stop somebody for tinted windows or for expired tags. But I think it's not a cookie cutter type of thing. You really have to decide where you're going to do something like that. Certain areas, certain urban areas, let's just be truthful, you know, you need to do those types of things because you got people running around here with guns. And there have been a lot of stops that Detroit police have done, you know, tinted windows, bad tags, cracked light, where they found guns or drugs in the car. You know, those are things. Now, you know, you can reduce that and not have that and, you know, just kind of let people go if they have an expired, you know, tag or tinted window. But you may be allowing some things to get into the streets that you don't want. Mm. And I know being a police officer is a dangerous job. I get that. But you know that going into it.
Yeah. The Chargers coach Jim Harbaugh said he was still processing everything going on with Sherrone Moore's firing when he was asked on Friday. But he went on the Dan Patrick show, and it seems like he's processed some things.
And still don't have my head wrapped around it. Dan, it's a tragedy, and you know, just praying for all concerned. I love my alma mater, love Michigan, but I love the Chargers too. And I'd be doing a disservice if I wasn't putting all my focus on the.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Jim Harbaugh.
We have another one. We'll hear from Jim Harbaugh later on in the show. There's one more bite where at least he talks about how he has been texting him.
Yeah, which is interesting too. 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. Constant Contact, the company sitting in a leadership position in the digital marketing space, has recently released research around how small businesses are faring today when it comes to marketing their businesses. The report from Constant Contact is known as the Small Business Now Report, and it reveals data relating to what small businesses are doing in the field of marketing today and how they're faring. The data comes from more than 2,500 small business leaders across the U.S. and the rest of the world. And among other interesting revelations is that fewer than 1 in 5 small business owners today say that they are very confident in the impact of their marketing efforts. The study identified a growing gap between the efforts small businesses put into marketing and their confidence in gaining meaningful business results. Despite increased marketing budgets and the broader adoption of tools such as email marketing, AI, and video, only 18% of small businesses today, that's down, by the way, from 27% in 2024, feel very confident in the effectiveness of their marketing. Constant Contact reports that economic pressure is forcing small businesses to pivot as part of that shift, and email has reclaimed the top spot as the most trusted channel for 44% of worldwide respondents in this study. Other data shows half of small businesses use AI for marketing, and 78% leverage video today, according to the data. Smita Wanhawan, Chief Marketing Officer at Constant Contact, noted that small businesses are under pressure to deliver positive marketing results, but feel they are doing more without getting more in return. They're working harder than ever, but without the time, expertise, or data to guide them, many are still guessing about what will resonate with their customers, she said. And according to Frank Vello, CEO of Constant Contact, in an interview with E-Commerce Times, the confidence gap voiced by a growing number of small business owners is driven by a perfect storm of economic pressure, complexity, and uncertainty, as Vella put it. They're navigating rising costs, which 44% cite as their top source of stress. So where is all this going in small business marketing? Vella went on to note that Constant Contact's research shows the next major shift is not about a single new technology, but rather the intelligent integration of the tools small businesses are already adopting, such as AI. The next wave of technology must address businesses' top struggle, not knowing what's working. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, and that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
So by now you've heard about the tweet the president put out after the brutal murder of Rob Reiner. Quote, the movie director and comedy star has passed away together with his wife, Michelle, reportedly due to the anger he caused others through his massive, unyielding, and incurable affliction with a mind-crippling disease known as Trump derangement syndrome. We also know that he doubled down in the Oval Office when he was asked about it, and since then there's been backlash. Let's bring in Jason Rowe, principal of Rowe Strategic. Good morning to you, Jason.
Good morning.
I assume that you're going to say that the tweet wasn't a good thing for the president to do. My question is, moving forward, are there cracks within his own base? Because a lot of people now have come out to say that was a horrible decision.
Well, it was appalling. I mean, there's just the lack of decency is obvious, and it comes across as deranged. It drew, fortunately, a lot of criticism from allies of the president, and deservedly so. Unfortunately, there were people, and there continue to be people, that defend it or brush it off, or, try to say, well, Democrats said this about Charlie Kirk, as if that justifies,
But it wasn't like the top-ranking Democrat.
No, it was not. It was not. I mean, that's what's, unfortunate. I think this is an opportunity for Republicans to step out and check the president on something he deserves to be checked on. Unfortunately, I've been reading through, news this morning, and it's not being mentioned anywhere because now everyone's moved on to the Susie Wiles interview with Vanity Fair. And, that's the nature of the media cycle that we live in now, that, outrageous things happen. And they're, we're outraged for about 24 hours, but it looks like we've already moved on from this.
And, Jason, Trump defended Susie Wiles after she described him as, like, having this alcoholic personality. Does that level of candor humanize the president, or does it reinforce concerns about, impulse and self-control?
Listen, we can see the guy. I don't think her saying it changes how anybody feels about him. He has an erratic style, always has. I think she is obviously indispensable, and it's interesting after those comments to see pretty much everyone that she criticized rushing to her defense. And some of those things, you could see how they were in context, probably not as incendiary as they read in the way they're presented. I haven't read the article. I've only read the excerpts that I've seen in media coverage of it. But I think it does show, that there is, even in normally chaotic White House, a little more chaos than we're even seeing.
I guess my question, a little bit to Jamie's point, is does that put Republicans in a tough spot, right? He comes out and says some terrible things about Rob Reiner. Then this piece comes out about Susie Wiles, and everybody has to kind of fit into that puzzle piece. Like, we're thinking midterms now. Does that put other Republicans in a tough spot?
Well, looking at the politics, and let me focus on the Reiner thing first. I mean, first of all, saying something decent or saying nothing at all costs nothing.
Right.
But
right.
What President Trump did was alienate a lot of swing voters because, mm-hmm. Quite frankly, and I think there's a bit of hubris on the right that we need to get over, that we won an election because we're better than the other side. The reality is we were running against worse candidates. Kamala Harris was arguably the worst Democratic nominee in the 21st century and the 20th century. She was terrible. And so this is not we're not enjoying a victory lap because we did such a great job. We're just less bad than them. And for swing voters that are right now navigating inflation and the economy and AI and all the things that are happening in this country, You know, when they're looking at the two parties, I would say this week we look a lot worse than the Democrats because of the Reiner thing. And so I think we're alienating people unnecessarily. And I think we need to get focused on the issues and stop with all the nonsense and noise. I think, you know, coupled with the Susie Wiles thing, it's just not a good look. I mean, you know, the president is making progress on a lot of things on the international stage. They are, you know, attempting to address the healthcare challenges. They certainly appear to be focused on inflation and affordability, but all of those efforts get buried in coverage of absolute nonsense that has nothing to do with doing the job of governing the country. And so I just don't think it's a great look. History is not on Republican side going into this midterm election, and I don't know why we are going to complicate it even more than the environment that we've got to navigate anyway.
I'm just wondering macro what you're seeing, you know, with Marjorie Taylor Greene sort of on the outs with everybody, people pushing back a little bit more when some of these tweets are a little crazier than the last. Do you see any cracks here?
Oh, I do. I think, you know, for a lot of people, they're starting to understand that MAGA is less a political movement and more a cult of personality, and that there's only one rule, which is to nod at everything that Donald Trump says and does with a smile. And, you know, there's still significant elements of the MAGA base that will never budge no matter what. I mean, you know, going back to what he said 8 years ago, that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. You know, I think with a good portion of the MAGA base, that remains true. It's about him. It's not about his beliefs. You know, he has flipped on a number of issues, and the base has just flipped with him rather than kind of holding him accountable. And I think when you talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene, and we've talked about it before, she didn't concoct something that she had, you know, a difference with Trump. She literally was holding him accountable to his own rhetoric and his own position. She didn't deviate. He deviated, and she stayed where he was. And that turned her somehow into a quote unquote traitor. So, yeah, I do think there's some fractures there. And, you know, with the base not turning out in these off-year elections and these special elections, and Republicans losing seats like, you know, in Georgia and Miami that we shouldn't have lost, and underperforming in races we really were never going to be competitive in anyway, we can't afford to have the base fractured even more when they're not even performing at a rate that we can rely on. And then, you know, how do you offset that when they don't turn out? Well, that is winning over and persuading swing voters to come to our side.
Right.
And what we're doing right now is not helping with that.
And the Reiner tweet was the opposite of doing that. Jason Rowe, we appreciate it. If we don't talk to you, Merry Christmas.
Yeah. Have a great holiday.
Guys. Thank you.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, this is, Lloyd, like, you like boxing.
I do.
This is like having somebody in the seventh round on the ropes, mm-hmm. wobbling, and then you turn around to showboat. You don't need to do it.
Nope.
Finish the job.
Yep.
Like, Democrats are on the ropes.
I feel like it's more like you punch yourself in the face.
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
If we want to go with the boxing analogy.
Yeah.
This was an own goal that didn't need to happen.
Look at these guys.
Let's talk about the economy next at 7:35.
Well, it broke just towards the end of our show yesterday. 64,000 jobs were added in November. That beat expectations. But unemployment ticked up from 4.4% to 4.6%. So a mixed bag. But what does that mean for the economy at large? What does it mean for the creation of these jobs? I mean, we just aren't seeing the amount of jobs being created at the rate we would all like.
Mm-hmm.
And then with unemployment going up, it just creates an added wrinkle where you go back to when those nearly million jobs were wiped off the books.
Yeah.
We just aren't creating at a fast enough pace. And what jobs are being filled right now? We're in the seasonal time of the year.
Yeah, right.
So how much of those are going to stick around? How many of them are permanent? There's a lot of questions about this economy, all while the president says 2026 is going to be gangbusters. And so that's when the economy is going to take off.
No, he says it's A++++ right now.
Well, that's his job approval. That's how he views his job that he's done.
But we've had a lot of months this year of, you know, job losses. I'm wondering.
Well, job creation has been good.
Yeah.
It's always been beating the expectations, but right. the unemployment rate's up.
Yeah. So is that a sign of the labor market cracking, or is this just a normal correction? I don't know.
I don't think it's a normal correction.
There's also this jump in the labor market of people who are working part-time who want to work full-time.
Mm-hmm.
And those who want a job but haven't looked in the past month. So that share was 8.7% in November, up a full percentage point since this time last year. So it does show some cracks here. And that's why I really wanted mm-hmm. to talk to Stephen Moore, a former economic advisor to President Trump. I mean, these economists are smart guys, and I wanted to ask some of these questions.
Sure. Yeah.
Here's the other question that I have is, are we going to get to the point where what is going to be the new normal? Because more and more companies are creating more and more opportunities for artificial intelligence, and that's going to create less of an opportunity for people to work full-time, part-time. That we're not there yet. We're not there yet. Okay. That's not today. That's not this jobs report. Nothing like that. But we are going to get in the next handful of years to a place where these jobs aren't being totally filled by people looking for employment.
Mm-hmm. Are you suggesting that's one of the issues here? AI?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. But when you're only adding 64,000 jobs, right? And I guess it was a bit of a paper tiger when we were adding 250,000
right,
jobs,
exactly.
220,000 jobs, especially when they all got rolled back. So maybe this is the normal, right? And that's, I think, a question for those that have their finger on the mm-hmm. pulse.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't help but look down the road and go, okay, well, what are we going to do with all these people? How are they going to be able to pay their bills, all while companies are looking to streamline and make things more efficient, and they're going to use artificial intelligence too? We've already seen that
mm-hmm.
to a much smaller degree. But we're generally in the infant stage
yeah.
of artificial intelligence.
There's a negative way of looking at numbers. There's an optimistic way of looking at the numbers, is that most of the bad news came from a survey of households, which could have been related to the shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
The employers survey, which came out, shows payroll estimates more encouraging, slow but positive job growth. So, like, can you look deeper into the numbers and see some positivity?
Yeah, there is good stuff there. I mean, again, whenever you're beating the expectations of a whole profession, mm-hmm. that's a good thing. But it's not great when unemployment goes up still. So to me, it's good and bad. That's what you get with a lot of these reports.
Well, and everything's unaffordable. I went and got like five things at the grocery store. It was $100. Like, things
yeah,
are a lot.
Yeah.
And J.D. Vance was in Pennsylvania saying to folks, like, quote, we've got to stay with it. We've got to keep working. We inherited a mess. This is Biden's fault. Just hang on with us. It's going to be great.
And that still may be the case. Time will tell.
Yeah, but we're getting close to a year now with this administration. How long is it going to be the previous's fault?
So you can't play that card forever.
No, you can't.
But the way that inflation rose during the Biden administration, partly because of, I mean, we're putting together $1 trillion bill packages, that was never the norm before. Now mm-hmm. that's how we operate. We're not bringing in enough money.
Right.
Inflation spikes. To beat inflation down with a stick takes a lot of time. It is difficult to do to get it back down to where it was before the Biden administration took hold. So all of a sudden, you find yourself, inflation still too high, way yeah. above where you want it to be.
Right.
That 2% mark, you're mm-hmm. hovering up above 3.
3, yeah.
And your job growth isn't where you want it to be. Your unemployment is going up. So it just right now, it doesn't feel like it. And to your point, the prices of things are still too high. Well, how do we bring that down? We try to bring the cost of energy down, which we haven't seen to the extent that I think people who voted for Donald Trump in November would like yet.
Well, and there's this idea like this is all Biden's fault, but this has been a full year with this president, yeah. inflation going in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
At
oh, yeah,
some
no,
point,
it's,
it, you know,
absolutely.
It's related.
I agree. And I think once you get past this 1 year mark, that card's over. Like you need yeah. to start taking meaningful changes here.
And I'm wondering, you know, how much confidence will the markets and policymakers have in this report, because Jerome Powell said that this delayed data is potentially distorted.
Sure.
Potentially.
I mean, there
so,
was
yeah.
a shutdown. And-
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It could definitely be distorted. We were talking about wrapping presents during the break.
Yes, we were.
I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all like to wrap. You like to rap?
I like to rap, because I like I said, my mom taught me. I'm a pretty good package rapper.
Yeah. I put tape on the gift. So I fold it over, I put tape down, then I fold the other side over, and I put tape down. Now, you both are looking at me like I'm an insane person.
No.
Is that an appropriate way to do it?
Yeah.
Especially
I've been told that is the wrong way.
Exactly.
I've been told that is not the appropriate way to wrap a gift. You fold it over, you put a piece of tape down.
I'm just trying my hardest.
I am trying my hardest. That's true.
Doesn't matter. No. Why is it wrong?
Yeah, because they're going to rip it off. Rip the paper off anyway. I mean, you want it to look nice, of course.
I like a taut wrap. I like a nice, tight.
Yeah.
Get it in there.
I do.
I like to the point where the edges break. You know, I like it real.
Uh-huh.
Got to get in there.
Yeah. No, I get that.
Well, you need really sturdy paper. Do you ever start rapping with like really cheap, flimsy paper?
Oh, and
you're
rips.
Like, well, this isn't going to work.
Yeah,
and you unwrap it.
Yep.
Take a drink of beer, whatever it is.
Or you don't cut enough paper.
I will say when I start to, when you don't cut enough, that is very frustrating. But I save it for other little gifts.
Well, no, yeah.
When I start wrapping, I do the nice tight wrap. I put a bow on it. I make it really nice.
Uh-huh.
By the end of my experience, they're not as nice.
Yeah, you've had a few pops and.
This present was wrapped at 9 p.m.
Yeah.
This present was wrapped at 12:30 in the morning.
Then you get the gift bags. Oh, the heck with that.
I know that's right.
What did we get out of Lansing in 2025? What do we expect in 2026? We'll talk to Bill Ballinger next.
Welcome back to JR Morning. It is 7:50 time for today's Capitol Report, sponsored by the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. 2025 was a dramatic year in Michigan politics, from heated debates over budget priorities and education policy to contentious local and state races that reshaped key legislative dynamics. Voters wrestled with national issues playing out at the state level, while contenders began laying the groundwork for the high-stakes 2026 election cycle. With ambitious campaigns already taking shape and critical policy decisions on the horizon, Michigan stands at a pivotal moment in its political journey. And joining us to kind of help us make sense of what we just lived through and what's ahead is Bill Ballinger. He's a longtime political analyst and founder of the Ballinger Report. Bill, thanks for being here.
Glad to be with you.
So when you step back and look at 2025, Bill, as a whole, how would you characterize this year in Michigan politics?
Turbulence in the state capitol upon occasion, and big rumbling run-up to the 2026 election, building up in campaigns behind the scenes outside the Capitol bubble.
Was this a year, you think, of some stability, or a year where the ground kind of started to shift?
I don't think we could ever describe what's going on in Michigan as stability. It seems like there's always something going on that kind of upsets the apple cart and keeps us occupied.
Were you surprised by the budget negotiations and how Matt Hall and the governor sort of were interesting friends throughout that?
Very much so. I mean, I think that's one of the big developments this year. First of all, Gretchen Whitmer's sudden friendship with President Donald Trump, with whom she had crossed swords on occasion, in fact, many times over the previous 4 years. And then the fact that Matt Hall, who I think for most people in Michigan is a fairly obscure figure, not known outside the Lansing bubble or his legislative district, which is near Kalamazoo. Outside of that, people don't really know him, but he really dominated state politics in Lansing this year. He kind of set the agenda. He struck up a relationship working very well with Governor Whitmer, and he kind of isolated the Senate Democratic majority. So I think, you have to look going ahead at what's going to happen in Lansing in 2026. There were three big issues in Lansing this year that Matt Hall was right in the center of, and we can go into those if you want to.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what you expect for next year, because I think that's going to be a busy one up there.
Well, the first thing I think people are going to be focusing on is how is the budget going to go next year? Because as you just hinted at, we had a long standing budget impasse leading up to September 30th, the end of the previous fiscal year. And we actually had a government shutdown for a couple of hours on October 1st. Technically, it didn't really make much difference. They got it done at the last minute. But the run-up to getting the budget done was not unprecedented, but extremely unusual. And then there was a battle early in the year, you may remember, over the so-called tipped wage for waitstaff in restaurants and paid sick leave. This was of great concern to small business. That dominated things for the first 2 months. And now, this week, the big event was that Matt Hall and the House Republicans literally shut down $660 million that were bound in already committed spending by the previous legislature for various local building projects. And the Democrats and the interest groups in Lansing are outraged, and the Senate Democrats yesterday passed a bill to restore all the funding that the House Republicans carved out, but you can bet that the House Republicans are probably not going to go along with it. Yeah. So we got a real impasse already on the budget, not just for the 2026, but for what supposedly was taken care of 2 years ago that the House Republicans have now blocked.
Bill, what do you think about the governor's race coming up? You see someone running away with it? It's going to be a pretty tight race with, you know, an independent
on the Republican
involved.
Side, John James, who has run twice for U.S. Senate and lost narrowly and is now a congressman, he is well ahead in the polls on the Republican side. Whether that will hold up all the way through next August 4th remains to be seen. That's when the primary is. On the Democratic side, I think Jocelyn Benson really seems to have things under control compared to Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist. I think he's, even though he's getting progressive support from the progressive side of the party, I think Jocelyn Benson should win the Democratic primary pretty easily. And so we'll see it, whether it's going to be Benson and or who on the Republican side, maybe James. And then we cannot forget Mike Duggan.
Right.
You know, the outgoing mayor of Detroit, who is running as an independent and has a genuine chance to win, in my opinion. If the two major party contenders chop each other up and people are sick of all the malaise and rancor and controversy in Lansing, and they say, let's turn to somebody who's shown as mayor of Detroit he can get the job done, and let's elect an independent. It's happened before in other states. Rarely, but it's happened.
Bill Ballinger, we appreciate you coming on, recapping 25 and looking ahead to 2026. Have a great weekend and a great holiday season as well.
Merry Christmas to you. Happy New Year.
You know, I agree that, you know, the mayor could possibly get in, but he still has a lot, you know, of ground to cover when it gets, you know, that name recognition in the other parts of the state. I mean, in independents, I mean, they're getting in a lot of, you know, states and cities as mayors and governors and things of that nature. So, I mean, it could happen.
And when it comes to that $645 million, there was a Senate Appropriations Committee hearing last night, and people were none too pleased about the cuts to this.
Yeah. None too pleased.
And, you know, these groups that expected this money to pay for stuff are like, we need it.
Yeah.
8 o'clock hour coming up on JR Morning. I'll tell you about a counterfeit cash printing operation that was busted in Detroit.
8:05. Good to have you this Wednesday morning. Donald
Uh-oh.
Trump.
Guess what day it is? Pump day.
That's right.
Set to address the nation tonight from the White House. 9 o'clock. You'll hear it here on WJR saying he will be giving an address to the nation. I look forward to seeing you then. It has been a great year for our country, and the best is yet to come, according to the president. So 9 o'clock tonight.
All right.
What are you guys doing?
Probably watching that.
Popping some popcorn.
I'm sure.
Either that or bedtime has extended way too late. And I will not be watching.
So Donald Trump talking tonight. And interestingly enough, on the issue that we thought maybe that would be discussed was the situation that continues to evolve with Venezuela. The naval blockade, Donald Trump says, is in place. Plus, you've got the defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, saying that he will not release the video of that second boat strike from September 2nd, which was the initial boat targeted in this operation. He will not release that video at you know, a bare minimum to members of Congress.
I don't get it. What are we hiding here? What's the big deal?
The claim is that there is an active operation going on in the waters there.
Okay, but you released all the other videos of this boat strike.
There have been other videos released, yes.
Lots of videos released on social media. And then when a question arises on that first one and what the second one was all about, now it's classified, we can't release it.
Right.
Interesting.
So what else can we talk about?
How about Rob Reiner, the situation with his son, Nick?
Yeah, absolutely. There are charges now, first-degree murder, 2 counts of that, but they may be seeking the death penalty, even though there's a moratorium on that in the state of California.
Right.
That, you know,
special circumstances,
there's a
right.
special circumstance here. And I also was thinking about our law enforcement folks we talk to all the time. When it's a stabbing, it's like a crime of passion.
Right.
And what we are hearing from reports that there was some sort of fight between the family at Conan O'Brien's house like 24 hours prior.
Right.
And then they're found dead the next day. So it's a sad family situation. I'm sad for this family who tried to get their son right for years and years and years.
And then there's this report that he was at Conan O'Brien's Christmas party and was acting very strange.
Mm-hmm.
He went up to, who was it? Bill
Hader.
Bill Hader.
And is like, what's your name? What's your last name? Are you famous? Like, at Conan O'Brien's Christmas party.
Right.
Probably.
And asking others.
There aren't just like schlubs there.
No, it's A-listers in this place.
Yeah. Bill Hader is a pretty known guy, especially in L.A. circles.
Yeah.
So the fact that he's like, are you famous?
And he was asked to leave.
And it became very awkward for the folks there.
Authorities have uncovered a counterfeit $100 bill operation linked to a Detroit home after a surge of fake bills in Canton Township and surrounding communities. The investigation launched in November involved Canton, Plymouth, and Northville police, along with the U.S. Secret Service, and officers traced the counterfeit cash to a home in the 17,000 block of Salem in Detroit, tied to nearly 50 businesses across southeast Michigan. A raid last week revealed printers and chemicals, tools and ink used to make these fake bills, as well as stolen firearms. The three men, 26-year-old Darian Daniels, 26-year-old Darren Daniels, 24-year-old Darian Daniels, and 25-year-old Renard Scales were arrested and charged with possession of counterfeit notes and counterfeiting tools. Darian and Darren also face weapons charges. The suspects were released on $10,000 personal recognizance bonds and are due back in court December 30th. I've seen a lot of businesses while I'm out, even in Southfield, Berkeley, say we can't accept $100 bills at this time. So I knew something was going on, and maybe it's tied to what happened here.
Also, the jobs report came out yesterday. 64,000 jobs created that beat expectations, but the unemployment rate goes from 4.4% to 4.6%. Let's check in with economist Stephen Moore, who joins us this morning. Stephen, it's good to have you. What'd you make of the report?
Stephen?
All right, we can't make a connection with him. We're going to try to work on that.
Yeah.
But again, the questions of how much of a robust report is this? How much does the shutdown have to do with it?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then, you know, you've got the conflicting news. Good news on the jobs created, not great news that the employment rate goes up.
That's right. And we're getting some more news on the Sharon Moore situation, mm-hmm. because Jim Harbaugh was asked about it again. When he was first asked about it, he said that he was still processing. He went on the Dan Patrick show and actually revealed that he's been in contact with Sharon.
Early December, but I have texted him.
Nothing since he was arrested.
Just text.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
How are his spirits?
I think there's... It's a tragedy. It's the worst days of his life, and you know, keep it together and take care of your family. That's, you know, that's the message. And getting spiritual guidance, you know, is really critical.
Yeah, so he's revealing he talked to him, that he's going through a lot right now, and Harbaugh's advice is take care of your family. I would say that he didn't do that prior to all this happening. But
I would agree.
I agree with that.
I appreciate Jim Harbaugh. I mean, look, one of the things about Jim Harbaugh, you know, for maybe some of the quirks that he possesses, he did talk about a family atmosphere when he was at Michigan. You know, at one point, you know, Jim Harbaugh is a very pro-life guy. Mm-hmm. At one point, he told his players that if they were to get pregnant and they didn't expect that or want it, that he would take the baby. Like, you know, he created...
He did say that. He said that he and his wife will take care of the babies.
Yes.
They need to be born.
So Jim Harbaugh created that type of atmosphere. I at least appreciate that you follow through with that, right? In this case, this is somebody you cared about. This is somebody you hired and brought into your family. And through a tough time, right? And we'll let everything litigate and play out.
That's the Christian teaching, isn't it?
Yes.
That you don't just throw people out.
That's true.
Humans make mistakes, and that he reached out to him and is showing this guy some support. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I think it's a worthy cause. How about the Red Wings last night? Come from behind win.
Yeah.
How about the Red Wings?
They look. I'll tell you, I was at the game. They looked not great in the first period, better in the second, and obviously it was a bigger third period for them. But, you know, they continue to play up and down hockey, but, you know, they're up atop with the standings. They are very much in the mix. And you know, there's a lot of questions about what comes down the pipe here over the next couple of months with Steve Yzerman.
Well, it's December. It's mid-December, and Alex DeBrincat now has 20 goals.
Yeah.
He's the fastest player, Red Wings player, to score 20 goals in a season since, do you want to guess?
Fastest player to 20 goals since Pavel Datsyuk.
Good guess, but it's Henrik Zetterberg, which happened in 2007-2008. So it's nice to have this guy, this person who can light the lamp every night on your team.
Yeah, and if it's, you know, again, like Dylan Larkin plays a totally different role on this team, right? You know, he's one of the best players in the league, but you can only be as good as your line mates. You can only be as good as the team you got around you. And he plays a specific role, and that allows DeBrincat to flourish, certainly. And
He's also scored 20 goals in each of his first three seasons with the franchise. The first time since that happened, you want to guess again? Like, go farther back.
We're playing trivia here today.
Red
Wing trivia.
Brendan Shanahan.
Yes.
No way!
Ding, ding, ding.
Pretty good.
Yay!
Hey, if you got packages you need to get out, you better get them out. We'll talk about it next on JR Morning.
We have talked about this, that I am a late bloomer, if you will, someone who gets their gifts at the very last minute, but I don't have to mail anything.
I don't think that's true. I think you do your due diligence and consider every option to make sure people in your life get the nicest things that you can
get. That's a nice thing to say. That I do try and do that in a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
But, but I don't have to mail anything. That is what's good about this last minute thing, but some people do. And what are the deadlines here when it comes to getting your packages to your loved ones on time? Let's ask Tim Norman, strategic communications specialist at USPS. How are you, Tim?
I'm fine. Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
Of course. So let's talk about these deadlines. If you're mailing holiday gifts, what is the absolute last moment people can do it?
Well, speaking of today, today's the 17th, so if you're shipping USPS Ground Advantage and First Class mail, this is the recommended date of today. Tomorrow would be Priority Mail, and then December 20th would be Priority Mail Express, and that would be the recommended dates by to get it there by Christmas Day.
So if someone ships today or tomorrow, which USPS service gives them the best chance without, like, really breaking the bank?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people really use Priority Mail. My wife has been sending packages this week. We do that every year, you know, because it's very easy to use. You can get the boxes at the post office, and it's very easy to, you know, get them in the mail. And so, you know, I would recommend Priority Mail for all your shipping needs. And, you know, there's all sorts of different sizes of boxes that you can get at the post office.
Talk about the work that the drivers do. I mean, they have a massive job all year, but especially around this time of year, they're inundated and they're hustling all over the place.
Yeah, you know, this is our 250th anniversary of the Postal Service. And so, you know, we've been doing this for many, many years. So, you know, our employees, they love this time of year because this is something that we call it our season to shine. And so, yes, you do have a lot more packages and things like that that are going through the system this year and during the holiday season. But, you know, I think with a lot of our employees, they're very dedicated. They know they're going to have a lot of hard work. But, you know, they want to get these packages, cards, and letters out to their customers. So it's one of those things. It's great camaraderie in the facilities where people are just, you know, working to get them out there to their customers. And so it's really a nice season that we always go through.
Yeah, it seems like people in the post office this time of year are friendly. You go ahead, I'll wait here, and that makes me feel pretty good. All right, and one last time, the deadline is what, Tim?
December 17th today for USPS Ground Advantage and your first class mail. Tomorrow, priority mail. And then December 20th, if you get to that point, you want to do priority mail express service.
All right, Tim Norman, we appreciate your time this morning.
Okay, well, thank you for having me, and happy holidays.
You
happy
as well.
Happy holidays.
To you. My son is a postal carrier, man. He works. I mean, this is his time, man, right now. I mean, he's even working on Sunday sometime, you know, delivering packages, man, you know, and delivering, you know, gifts and everything. So, yeah, this is his this is the heat, man, for him.
This is his Super Bowl.
It is. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I'm always trying to say, hey, thank you. Like, I'm trying to always catch them. They're on fast mode.
No.
Like, I just can't even get to
them.
They
have no time for you.
No,
like, thank you. Appreciate it. And they're like, whatever, I got to go. Like, they're in the zone.
Yeah.
So, but we owe
Which
them
reminds
a lot.
Me, I have to go get my cash for my people that I thank throughout the year. And one of them is our post office. Postal carrier.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know. We always try to give them gift cards or something for them. Because that's an exhausting job. And it's like every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get past Thanksgiving and it is full steam ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know my son said he's got great people on his route, and he has a lot of older people and veterans and stuff. And he said, you know, he'll talk to them, and they, you know, he's really struck up friendships with a lot of those people. A lot of them are home alone, you know, lonely, and you know, he just chats with them, man, you know, and they have a good time.
I was talking to a buddy of mine, and he was saying he's going home for Christmas or coming home for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, everybody's kind of on the same political spectrum, you know? But he's like, I just don't want to come home and talk about politics and talk about all the craziness.
Yeah.
He's like, we try to avoid it. Like, everybody dances around it, but then somebody says something just, you know, not even to stir anything up, because everybody's kind of relatively on the same page, but like just something that said like, oh, did you see the news? This happened. And then that starts that's the snowball.
Yes.
Right. And then all of a sudden it's a boulder, and they're just like, I just don't want to do that. I'm like, well, then just don't do it. Like, say right off the rip. Like, if they bring up something from the news, just say, like, I don't want to do that. Can we just not talk about that?
Yeah.
Like, even if it's something good, I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about something.
Keep it light.
It does feel inevitable, though, for a lot of these gatherings that people get together.
That's not the point. Like, can we just for one day not talk about all this?
You know what was funny? So yesterday I went and read Christmas stories and talked about our Christmas traditions to Henry's 3-year-old class.
Okay.
Yesterday.
Were they attentive?
They were great.
Okay.
They were great. They were wonderful little kids. Henry was like standing next to me. He's like, "And Dad, what about the elf? Can you tell him about it?" And I'm like, yeah. But it was funny to like hear, because some of these kids don't celebrate Christmas. Some celebrate Hanukkah. Some celebrate Diwali. Mm-hmm. Some celebrate, like, they celebrate all these different things. And it was interesting to see and hear them like absorb something totally different.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, you get cookies? And I'm like, well, we make cookies for Santa. And I said, then we leave out carrots for the reindeer. And they're like, the reindeer eat carrots? And we're like, well, yeah, they're hungry. And then I'm like, you know, they're busy delivering presents all over the world. And they're like, well, Santa doesn't come back. And I'm like, right, because you don't celebrate Christmas. For those that celebrate Christmas, and they're like, this is pretty good. Like, your thing is wonderful. It's a great, your traditions and your holidays are great. but they're like, ooh, like, oh, you sprinkle glitter on your front porch so Santa sees you? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, wow.
It's just amazing that they...
I left there and I left the teacher. I'm like, please apologize to all the parents. I didn't want to, like... I was just telling them what we do. And it was very funny. It was very cute.
That's funny. So you had some tough questions.
Sweating? Of course I was. The last thing I need is like a parent to come up to me and tap me on the shoulder and go like, hey.
Yeah.
Now my kid wants to celebrate Christmas. Like,
he likes what you guys do.
I said, but it's also a time to help others. It's also a time to give back. It's also a time to help other people that might need a little help.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, yeah, but what about the cookies? I'm like, yeah, that's
well,
good.
They're three carrots. And four.
And the cookies and the carrots.
They're three and four. But this time of year, it brings that out. And yeah, and I love it's the kid thing is really special. And you're going through it now with Liv.
I feel like you got the
grandkids.
Yep.
Time.
It's perfect time.
Not yet 3.5, and she just loves it. She loves the elf. She loves
Donnie.
Yeah, she named it Donnie, which is an odd name, but, you know, we're like, hey, it's Donnie, I guess.
That's what was in her heart,
I guess.
She loved seeing Santa. She just ran up to him with her letter and told him what she wanted, and she talks about Christmas every day. It's just like, this is a wonderful, wonderful time.
Every time we have dinner.
Ho, ho, ho!
Every dinner now, Henry's like, this is the greatest Christmas dinner ever.
Wow.
Every meal we eat.
This
is the greatest Christmas lunch ever. And I'm like, glad you like it. It's not Christmas.
he's willing it closer.
Your days are all mixed up.
He's willing it closer to him.
This is the greatest Christmas pizza I have ever had. All right. God bless you. All right. We'll take a break. More coming up. Pure Michigan encouraging travelers to do this. It's next.
Well, as the holiday season approaches, many people are rethinking traditional gifts and looking for experiences that create lasting memories. Travel is emerging as one of the most meaningful ways to give back, supporting local businesses and strengthening communities and showcasing everything our state has to offer, especially during these winter months. And joining us to talk about giving the gift of travel and how it boosts Michigan's local economy is Kelly Wolgamott. She is Vice President of Pure Michigan. Kelly, thank you so much for being here.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So every holiday season we talk about things, but Pure Michigan is really pushing experiences. So, you know, why does travel make such a powerful gift?
Right. So the gift of travel really means giving experiences, memories, personal growth, and really stronger lasting bonds with those that you love. You know, there's so many benefits with giving the gift of travel. It's about providing a break of new perspective, cultural immersion, and just a chance to unplug with your family. And it does provide, you know, Pure Michigan and the various destinations across the state really provide that opportunity to reawaken joy and just to provide, you know, something a little bit unconventional, perhaps, that from your typical holiday shopping, whether it not be, you know, a surprise trip or just a gift card to a local restaurant or to a attraction that you've been wanting to do. Maybe you've been wanting to go kayaking, right, at Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore. It's a great opportunity, really, to provide a unique, really meaningful and lasting gift this holiday season.
And there's really no deadline. You can make this decision at the last minute and go online and get it.
You're right. It's great for the last minute shoppers, right?
Well, and I mean, you don't have to just, if you like to go skiing or snowboarding, you can book that at Treetops or Boyne or anywhere in the state.
Crystal.
Yeah.
Crystal, if you want to play golf, you can book that and have something to look for when the weather gets a little warmer, too.
Absolutely. And that's the power of this and really the joy of giving the gift of travel, that it's something that you can look forward to. I think that's the power of travel as well. We get so excited about planning our trip and we're going to spend this amazing time in Pure Michigan with our family and friends. And it really provides us with something to look forward to and to plan together.
I know the governor says that giving the gift of Michigan can really deepen the impact of the holidays. And so kind of talk about how travel spending ripples through local communities. It's a big boost.
Yeah, it is a big boost. And, you know, the industry in 24, we welcomed over 131 million visitors to the state. And that economic impact was $54 billion to the state when we talk about the visitor spending and the tax revenue. So travel, it moves the Michigan economy and continues to just be a powerhouse when it comes to that economic development. But, you know, we also talk about this time of year shopping local and the impact that we can have in our local communities when we are doing our holiday shopping. And, you know, visiting our local communities is incredibly powerful in helping small businesses, keeping, you know, our neighbors and friends employed at those businesses, but it also brings in like $1.9 billion into the economic vibrancy as well. And it really helps those businesses sustain through the new year as well.
I mean, really, Michigan is a four-season destination, really.
Oh my gosh, we are a four-season mecca, and there's each season really provides us with just a great experiences to the state. I always tell people that, you know, we have these incredibly beautiful destinations that we enjoy all summer, all fall. But, you know, you can also this winter experience, go to Tequamenon Falls. If you've never been to Tequamenon Falls in the winter, it is incredibly breathtaking. So calming walking through the woods, so quiet and peaceful with the snow and just, you know, even, you know, Sleeping Bear Dunes is another great example. Those destinations are available to us in every season we have in here in the state. We're incredibly blessed to have this natural resources. So, you know, there's opportunities all winter long to get out and enjoy our beautiful state.
Kelly Wogelmont, Vice President of Pure Michigan, always appreciate you coming on, giving us some good ideas, some good things for Christmas, some good Christmas gifts as well. Travel, that's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
They also hear talk about locally crafted goods, like stuff made here. Mm-hmm. The Mackinac Island Fudge, the Shorts mm-hmm. Brewing, you may know. Shaggy Skis, I didn't know about. And so I clicked on the link. You can customize your skis. So if you're a skier, that's a great idea as I look for more ideas.
Customize your skis for what?
Well, for skiing.
Like
in terms of you get these.
To know for me, dog.
You get the skis to the terrain that you like. That's one way to customize it.
Sure.
But you could put different, like, pictures on the ski.
Got it. Well, that's cool. You could personalize it. Then.
For skiing?
Well, yeah.
Oh, boy.
I'm just making sure.
I love these guys. You just don't know.
I didn't know how we were doing this. Did you see Warner Brothers and Warner Brothers Discovery? Their board had urge shareholders unanimously to reject this
hostile takeover. Not happening.
That's not happening. This bid from Paramount, which came in after the Netflix bid.
Yes,
right. So there was the talk of, well, now you're creating a monopoly. It's too much of a market share. The influence is too high, and Paramount comes in after that and says, well, how about this thing?
Yeah,
and Warner Brothers is saying no. This is the deal that we made, the deal that we liked is with Netflix, and that's the way we should go. But I guess you'd make the argument, because it is a better deal. It's a bigger money deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't these board members have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders to make the most money?
Yeah.
That would be their job.
Uh-huh.
I'm curious as to the inner workings of this, because if the deal is bigger, you know, a little bit bigger, Why wouldn't you want that deal instead?
Well, the Netflix deal, does that include the news section like CNN? And
no.
Yeah, so the Paramount deal, you know, included that, I believe, the CNN
mm-hmm.
in there. And I know the president said, you know, he wanted whatever deal went through to include CNN. I don't know why he said that, but he wanted that. So could he throw a monkey wrench, try to
Well, I've not seen him react to this news.
Not to this breaking news. No. The president's son-in-law, too, pulled out of backing that hostile takeover mm-hmm. with money. So he was out anyway.
But, again, how much of a landscape changer this would be if Netflix takes control of this? I mean, if you had Paramount come in with this type of move, same deal. I mean, you're still talking about monopolizing the industry.
Yeah.
But the board is against this, which I find pretty interesting, really.
I think all the people think would be interesting how much they're paying a month. And if there's a monopoly, they may pay more.
It will.
Of course, yeah.
What it would go up, we don't know.
Right.
Well, I mean, or do you keep like HBO Max and that whole entity separate? Right? Because that's a whole other revenue stream. That's its own app. They already have a base there. Or do you just roll it all into one app and say, pay us $70 a month?
Yeah. Yeah, that could happen.
People are still going to pay more money, though.
Yeah.
In the long run. All right, we'll take a break. Name that tune coming your way. We've got Josh Groban tickets if you'd like to participate. 800-859-0957. That's next on JR Morning.